it please the court. I'm David Green on behalf of the appellant, Dennis Justy. And we're here because of a directed verdict that occurred in this case, which was a result of error and mistake. This case began when the court initially indicated that the court was inexperienced, had no prior experience in civil trial, and would rely heavily on counsel throughout the proceedings. Unfortunately, the court throughout the proceedings relied heavily on its relationship with opposing counsel and gave the appellant's counsel no deference whatsoever. Beginning with the opening statement, Mr. Morse, in opening statement, admitted that the condo association owned the property, number 18, of Rio Condominium Association, and represented that this was the developer for that building. Previous to that, there had been a motion for summary judgment in which there were admissions that there was an affidavit submitted by the defendant of Brian Lentz, in which he admitted that the Rio Condominium Association had hired Colorado Management Company since 1981 to repair and operate the premises. There was also the minutes of Rio, which indicated that they had an ongoing relationship as a landowner status, in which they not only delegated their authority to manage the condo, but also directed the condo as to what repairs were needed and when they were done.
Mr. Green, let me ask you, that's all well and good, and I understand your point. What evidence did you put on at the trial regarding ownership?
At the trial, I intended to put on the management agreement, which was Exhibit 7A. And that management agreement starts out by saying the Condominium Association is the landowner through pursuant to a landowner plan that was registered in the County of Grand. That would have been put on had I not been misled into believing, and I truly feel that I was bushwhacked at trial in that Mr. Morse, in opening statement, indicated that he would bring his witness. He said at the noon conference the day of the directed verdict that he was bringing his witnesses from Denver, which included Mr. Caruso, who was their expert witness and had knowledge and information about all the issues regarding ownership and control, including that maintenance agreement.
Why does that matter? You have a duty to put on a prima facie case, and I'm not hearing you tell me you did. Am I right that there was no evidence of ownership that you put on in your case? True? I understand maybe you thought you could on their case, but you didn't put on any on your case.
No. In the case, I was relying on the admissions that were in the file, the admission from the answer that said there was ownership and control. There was admissions number 6 where they indicated they admitted to the Colorado management agreement, in which that was intended to be put on. Had I not been told by the court that I could put on further evidence, I would never have rested. I told the court I did not want to rest. I felt pressured. It was at the end of the day. I was completely exhausted because the night before I was stranded at Berthoud Pass. And it was, it didn't seem reasonable for me at that time to put on I was expecting to put on the witness the next day that had come up from Denver. And in fact, when the court indicated that the representative from the corporation, I asked the court permission to do that. I asked the court, can I put on this witness as an evidence right in front of the court? And the court had full ability to hold any of the witnesses that had come up from Denver to testify at that time.
And who is the witness that you expected to put on that afternoon that you weren't able to call? Could you identify who it was?
Yes, it would have been Tom Caruso. He was identified in opening statement that he was going to be put on.
He's an agent of Roe Condominium, is that what you're saying?
He's the expert witness for the Condominium Association.
What testimony do you think he would have supplied that would have made your prima facie case?
He would have supplied the evidence that he had reviewed the maintenance agreement, Exhibit 7A, that definitely indicated that they were the owners and operators of the premises. That they,
anything else that he would have said?
He would have said that the he had all the evidence. He had listed the admissions, that admission number 6 indicated that this was, they had operated the premises. He had reviewed the answer, which would have indicated that they owned and they operated the premises. He would have reviewed all the documents that were provided to me in discovery that I had listed in my brief.
Do you have an agreement with counsel that rather than call him in your case, you would just do it once when he's called in their case? Did you have such an agreement with the defense counsel?
I believed I did. I believed that when he said he was going to bring his witnesses in that afternoon, that I would be able to call those witnesses.
Let's talk about this one witness, because there's only one that you've identified. Caruso is the one that you say would have supplied evidence of ownership, right?
Yeah, and this
and you had an agreement?
A second witness that would have supplied ownership.
Assuming that they would have testified that there was ownership.
Yes.
Is there anything else that they would have added to your case?
They would have showed that they operated the premises. They would have been able to indicate that Mr. Justy had been there as their guest, that he was a business invitee.
My understanding of the statute, the premises liability statute, says that you, an invitee, which I gather is what you claim your client was, can recover for damages caused by the landowner's unreasonable failure to exercise reasonable care to protect against dangers of which he actually knew or should have known. Was Mr. Caruso going to testify that the landowner, assuming that they were the landowner, knew or should have known of this?
I believe through his testimony I would have been able to establish that that the stairs were 10 inches, that we had photographs of my client's foot that showed about more than a third of his foot overhang on those stairs, that they were extremely narrow, and that there
was... That proves the defect, but how does it prove that the Roe Condominium Association knew or should have known that existed?
Well, because the Roe Condominium Association had been there since the outset, I would have established that those stairs had been there since whenever they started. The condominium management company had been working there since 1981. I would have been able to establish on a daily basis that anyone using those premises would know that these are very steep, narrow steps. I would have shown through the photographs that these steps were way too steep for my particular client, who was 6'5 and had a size 13 shoe, and we did have the photographs as well.
Why don't you put them on your case? That's what I don't understand.
I did put other photographs on in my case.
All right, so I guess I've come back to Judge Richmond's question. I'm still not hearing the evidence. Well, I guess I'll ask two questions. How does this evidence, these photos, prove that they knew or reasonably should have known of this defect? Number one, and how do you know what the witnesses would have testified? My understanding is you didn't depose anybody. So you say you would have been able to establish all this, but how do you know?
Well, I know because the photographs were black and white. I know because when I see the photographs, it was so obvious. It was so obvious that his walking on those stairs would have been terribly dangerous. We put on quite a bit of evidence during the case in chief regarding the measurements of the steps, showing that they were much steeper and much narrower than most steps are. And when you see those photographs, it's absolute proof. The proof is right in the pudding from looking at the photographs. I think any reasonable person would have realized that this company that's been there for so long, this is an accident waiting to happen. You've got ski boots, you've got all sorts of boots that are going up and down. You've got time in the winter where it's going to be slippery. And when you have this situation where you can't even put your foot on the platform and you have a third of your foot overhanging, that's an accident waiting to happen. And there's a low overhang as well. And there was also a defective railing that we had testimony to. So Mr. Justy is going down these steps without a reasonable railing, with an overhang that made him bend backwards because he's 6'5", and he slipped and fell. And it was a situation that I think a jury would see that this needed to be remedied. And I could have established that through cross-examination.
Mr. Green, let me ask you really a procedural question, and I'll be very candid with you about at least one of the problems I have with your case. I'm concerned about the rules that you're asking us to adopt, because here what we had is a directed verdict motion where the defense argued you didn't put any evidence connecting Roe to the property, you didn't show this, you know, new or reasonably should have known, etc. Then you say, but wait, I want to reopen. I mean, I have a real concern as to whether that undermines Rule 50 altogether, because in every case, somebody messed up, they didn't put on the evidence they should have, they got a directed verdict motion, then the plaintiff's lawyer said, but wait, I want to call somebody else to try to fix it. So I'd be interested in your response to that concern about the rule, and I guess related to that, there are out-of-state cases that I have seen that requires you to make the party in that position to make an offer of proof. Would you agree with me that you need to make an offer of proof as to the evidence you're going to put on?
Yes, and I did make an offer of proof.
Right. And your offer of proof, I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Please go ahead.
Well, first of all, I don't think every case the attorney or his client feels bushwhacked by the court. I don't think they feel like the court said, you must move forward with this case. When I said, I don't want to rest, this is the end of the day. I don't want to rest. And it was only until she said, you can put on more evidence, that I said, okay. And I felt like I was induced into a situation where Mr. Morse had represented not only an opening, but during the noon recess, that he was bringing in these witnesses who could testify. I knew it was too late to testify that day. Then when I said to the court, I need time to present this at the next morning, the court just simply said no. And you know, in a motion to reconsider, it's supposed to be immediate. This was immediate reaction by my part. The witness, Ms. McMahon, would have been able to establish through Exhibit 7A land ownership. And that would have been the link that the court was looking for to connect the defendant to the property. And it would have been that simple and that easy. It's not every case where you have witnesses right in front of the court. You got evidence. And I had made an offer of proof to provide to the court Exhibit 7A, and the court refused that. And I think that was unreasonable and unarbitrary. Me and my client both felt that we had a high road to go in this particular case, because the court is telling Mr. Morris, well, I rely on you. Be gentle with me. You were the public defender, and I always came to you and said, I didn't want to ask you what the answer was, but I knew you knew what the answer was. Every single time the court said, you know what the answer was, the court never gave that kind of deference to me. Obviously, the court, when it said the pleadings don't matter, what's stated in opening statement don't matter, was wrong. The case of Skeen versus Cole clearly says that you can't change your position once you have admissions in the record.
Well, the admissions changed. I mean, you're talking about an admission, and correct me if this is wrong, but I think they made admission in the answer to the original complaint. Then there was an amended complaint, and they didn't make that same admission. Then there was the trial management order where there was no stipulation as to ownership. So I guess I would, from my research, I think you're probably right. It would be evidence, but it's certainly not an admission anymore.
Well, you know, in LaRocco versus Dan Fernandez, the court said that it is inherent in the court's duty to look at those admissions and look at the pleadings, look at the opening statement. If they had done that, they would have realized that there wasn't just the answer where it made admissions, but in the discovery and the request for production number 6, they admitted that Exhibit 7A was their exhibit, and that was the management agreement that would have established control right there. There was admission in the discovery that they had insurance that would cover this incident. This is evidence of ownership and control. Had I been able to come back the next day because of the blackout, I wasn't able to access my files. Had I been able to come back the next day, I could have pointed all those things out to the court. And when Mr. Morse said that it doesn't matter what's in the admissions, the court relied on that. So I feel like the cases of LaRocca versus Fernandez and Skeen versus Kroll clearly show that what is in the pleadings is binding and that it obviates the need for additional proof. That's, those cases said that you can't, when the defendant says that he's the defendant driver in a case, when the defendant admits that in the answer, and then at trial says, no, I don't know who was driving the car, you can't change your position. In that particular case, they also admitted in opening statement that he was the driver. In this case, Mr. Morris admitted that Rio was the homeowners association for the property. Those things combined with the admissions in the, not only that, but the affidavit of Brian Lentz, which was submitted in the case, was an admission. That showed that the condo association was owned and operated by the defendant Rio.
Mr. Green, I see you're out of time.
Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Stuart Morse, MORSE number 16978, on behalf of the respondent, Roe Condominium Association. I want to be very careful about the way I say certain things because, you know, it's not very often that you get called a liar this many times in pleadings and in open court, but it's a little bit difficult to respond to some of these things when you look objectively at the record and then you look at the hyperbole in the argument. And I want to try as best I can to address exactly what Judge Gabriel brought up in his question to Mr. Green, and that is, what rule is the plaintiff asking you to adopt here? What basically this plaintiff is asking you to do is to say, everybody gets a do-over no matter what. Here's your mulligan. You didn't prove your case. Sorry, defendant. You may have been preparing based upon the expectation, and in fact I was, that the plaintiff wouldn't prove this element of his case, because if you'll notice in the record on appeal, if you look at the exhibits that were attached to the trial management order, the plaintiff never identified one single solitary witness that the plaintiff intended to call to prove the defendant's relationship, if any, to this accident, much less, as Judge Gabriel pointed out, and I believe as Judge Richmond pointed out, the absolute requirement that the premises liability statute has of showing that the defendant knew or reasonably should have known of the alleged defect. Now, I would argue that in this particular case, and you don't know this simply because the plaintiff didn't make this record for you, that Mr. Justy would never be considered a, quote, invitee, as that term is defined in the premises liability statute, as to the RHO Condominium Association. In fact, the only record that exists in the trial court is found at Exhibit B, which was defendant's exhibit, and that's page 1313, 1314, and 1315 of the record, which clearly shows that Dennis Justy, the plaintiff in this case, was a guest of Vacations Incorporated. There's no evidence of Mr. Justy being a tenant, licensee, invitee, or otherwise, as to RHO Condominium Association. The other thing that Mr. Green was fast and loose with is...
Let me ask you a question, if I may. Did the judge give an oral ruling on the motion for directed verdict, or do we only have the minutes?
Give an oral ruling, Your Honor.
Did she make a finding as to whether he failed to show that he was an invitee or what his status was? Was that part of her ruling?
Those words did not show up in the transcript. However, what she did say was that the plaintiff had not made a prima facie case under the premises liability statute.
She wasn't specific about the status.
That's correct.
Was she specific?
However, she was, I will tell you, she was very specific about the issue of ownership. But she did say there is no prima facie case of a violation of the statute.
She said there was no connection to Mr. Justy's injuries to your client, I think. She used the word connection, if I recall.
That's true, too, Your Honor. But I think the part and parcel of that is the statute itself, which requires those ends to be tied up, if you will. You have to prove those things. You have to prove what the relationship is. Therefore, then the judge can then make a ruling, as only the judge may do, as to what the status of the plaintiff is as to this particular defendant. None of that evidence ever was put on.
There was no specific comment by the judge as to whether there was a failure to prove knowledge, actual knowledge, or should have known.
I did not understand in the record, Judge Riefman.
Let me, if I can ask a question while we stopped you,
please.
Mr. Green. We've heard, and I appreciate your not getting into the personal arguments back and forth, because those are seemingly unpersuasive regardless of which way they go. So thank you for not going there. Mr. Green makes a vigorous argument that there were admissions in the record, throughout the record, about ownership or your clients operating the property and the like. I think I saw some of those myself, or at least got close to that. I guess I'd just be interested, as a matter of fact, whether there were such admissions in the record, whether they would have been admissible as evidence or whatever. Was there some admission in the record that your client was in fact an owner or operator of this property, and in fact, were they a landowner? Putting aside for the moment whether they put on the evidence of that, was there such evidence in the record?
Your Honor, let me first respond to that question by addressing one of the last things Mr. Green said in his argument, and that was that Brian Lentz made a quote admission. Now, I take the word admission as a legal term of art. I believe that was the intent in the argument that it was given to you, that Brian Lentz's statement was a quote admission. Brian Lentz was the president of Colorado Management Company. Brian Lentz was the president of a non-party entity to this lawsuit. CMC had originally been sued, but was dismissed out on summary judgment. So, therefore, there's no admission on the part of RHO Condominium Association with respect to Mr. Lentz. Now, getting to the other two, if you can call them that, quote, admissions, unquote. If you look at the complaint, which is found on page 1 of the record, paragraphs 2 and 3 of the complaint read as follows. Defendant is a Colorado company licensed to do business in the state of Colorado. That's in paragraph 2. That's correct. We admitted that part. It is currently in good standing. That was correct as well, so we had continued to admit. Defendant's principal place of business is located at 126 High Country Drive, Winter Park, Colorado, 80482. Now, one thing that's important for you judges to know is the fact that the RHO Condominium Association is merely one of many condominium associations that exist at a complex, an overall larger complex called High Country House. Okay? So, but again, the plaintiff didn't put that evidence on.
Paragraph 3 say.
I'm getting there, Your Honor. I apologize. The rest of paragraph 2 identified who our registered agent was, and we didn't deny that. Paragraph 3 says the defendant operates a condominium building located at 126 High Country Drive, Winter Park, Colorado, specifically building number 18 of the High Country House condominiums.
Your response to that paragraph?
We admitted that paragraph in the original complaint.
And then they amended the complaint and you changed it.
We changed that in the subsequent answer to the amended complaint. However, Your Honor.
Explain that?
I apologize.
Can you explain that?
Can we?
You operated on this day, but 6 months later, whenever it was filed, you no longer were the operator? That's not what you're saying, is it, Mr. Morris?
It's because I believe, Your Honor, that we were worried about being in this position right now, and that is, what does operate mean? Because the premises liability statute does not discuss the term operate. It talks about whether you are an owner. Moreover, even if Mr. Green had been successful in putting on Exhibit 7A and having it introduced into evidence, there's no evidence in there of the nature that would be required in order to prove a prima facie case of premises liability statute. The second thing, and I vehemently disagree with Mr. Green, there is absolutely no offer of proof that was given as to what any witness would or would not say relative to the premises liability statute and the defendant's liability to the plaintiff under that statute. Instead, he did ask to put on Ms. McMahon, who was a representative of the HOA, but, Your Honors, she'd never even been endorsed as a witness in this case, ever, not once. She wasn't listed on the trial management order. She wasn't a witness in this case. She was merely the face of an HOA. And that's all the jury knew. And Mr. Green, I think, would be very hard-pressed to give you any specifics as to what this witness would say. I happen to know what she would have said, but again, that's not in the record, and I don't think it's really relevant for me to argue to you. The point of the matter is, though, further, is that absolutely unequivocally, there's nothing in Tom Caruso's testimony as an expert that would have proven this integral and completely necessary point of ownership and knowledge and all of the other elements of the premises liability statute. To the contrary, Tom Caruso was my expert. He was going to come in and testify there's nothing wrong with these stairs, the stairs that he examined. They all met code. This building was built back in the early 1970s, and he would testify that code changed over the years. Different iterations required different things under the code, and he would say that when this was built, absolutely met code. So how that then transposes into testimony for the plaintiff improving essential elements of his claim is really lost upon me, and it's clearly lost in the record because it's simply not there.
Mr. Lentz available to be called by the plaintiff at trial? He lived right up there in Winter Park, as I look at the TMO.
As far as I'm aware, his business was up there. He could have subpoenaed Mr. Lentz. He could have subpoenaed anybody that he wanted to.
Mr. Lentz could have testified as to the connection between the management company, if any, and Roe Condominium.
I suppose that's possible, yes.
But he didn't call Mr. Lentz.
No, he did not call Mr.
And
Lentz. Nor was he under subpoena to be called. And at the time the defendant made its motion for directed verdict, here we are in the middle of the second day. I would disagree a little bit with Mr. Green's characterization of when things were over. The fact of the matter is that his last witness was finished testifying approximately 2 p.m. on the afternoon of the second day of trial. And because of all of the argument and because of all of the information that the court went through, by the time she ultimately made her ruling and dealt with the jury, then it was 4:20 in the afternoon. Getting back to the point of Mr. Lentz, however, he was never listed as a witness either by the plaintiff or the defendant.
He was a may call witness by you.
Well, as a may call, yes.
Whatever that
but
means.
But not as a will call. Well, whatever that means, Your Honor, and that's another point that I would like to bring up, is one of the other decisions I think that will be important for this court to make is, do the rules of civil procedure matter? Do you care? If your answer is, no, we don't care, do whatever you want to, everybody gets a do-over, go with the plaintiff. But I don't believe that's what the rules are for. I don't believe that that's what this court and the Colorado Supreme Court have adhered to in their decision making. The fact of the matter is that there are rules there, and they are there not only for the plaintiff to take advantage of, but for the defendant to be protected by and be able to prepare their case in accordance with.
Mr. Morse, I agree with you that the rules are there for a purpose, but it's not unusual for counsel to have an agreement that in order to save time, instead of calling the witness twice, we'll just do our cross-examination of Mr. Lentz when you call him. Did you have such an agreement with Mr. Green in this case with regard to Mr. Lentz or even with regard to Mr. Caruso?
Unequivocally, I did not. In fact, what I would say is that I told Mr. Green that if it was necessary, because, Your Honors, I mean, this might sound arrogant, it might sound like I was presupposing things, but I knew, based upon the preparation or lack thereof of this case for trial, that the plaintiff was not going to put this evidence on. I had no intention of proving his case for him. But the fact of the matter is that I never promised to bring any witness in. I told him that if it was necessary for me to put on a defense, I had two potential witnesses for that afternoon. One of them was a private investigator who had conducted surveillance of the plaintiff, and the other was Tom Caruso. Now, the private investigator, I have no idea how she could prove any element of his case. I doubt that very highly. Mr. Caruso, again, contrary to Mr. Green's argument, would not have proven any of the elements of plaintiff's case. And I think that it's anathema to me to think that the defendant's going to call a witness that's going to make plaintiff's case for them. It makes no sense. I did not do that, and I would not have done that. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.